Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. And if you're a big fan of Miles Davis, well, today is your day because I'm going to dedicate the entire hour articles about Miles Davis. And then the classic album review of The Rising by Bruce Springsteen. Miles at 100. Man in Motion. Miles Davis, who would have been 100 this May the 26th, was never content with his stellar achievements or his place in the world. Defiant in the face of racism, uncompromising in his quest for perfection, blazing a trail for new sounds, championing wave after wave of young musicians, he embodied the idea of progress in music, and today, over 30 years since his passing, still does. Over 12 pages, Mojo tackles the five phases of his career, tracing his extraordinary trajectory. Ever onwards, ever forwards, always miles ahead. Miles, 1926 to 1955. The Cool Ruler. From Charlie Parker to Gil Evans and beyond, how Miles Davis broke the bonds of bebop and set a new path for music. Gil Evans didn't care whether his Manhattan apartment did or didn't have. In 1946, when the Canada native returned to New York after enlisting in the U.S. Army during World War II. He only wanted to be close to the new jazz action. His basement space at 14 West 55th Street, little more than a bed, a piano, and a record player, quickly became an all-hours hub. Evans' place was three blocks north of Swing Street, the jazz epicenter, where clubs including the Three Deuces and Onyx helped birth bebop. He had fallen for the explosive jazz strain while playing in military bands during the war, so he began incorporating those sounds into the Claude Thornhill Orchestra, the unconventional ensemble for whom he'd been arranging since the decade's start. "I wrote the bebop things because I wanted to," Evans remembered in a 1978 interview. "If Claude didn't want me to do it, he could fire me." In the summer of 1948, Thornhill did fire Evans, but not before a 21-year-old trumpeter named Miles Davis heard and liked what Evans was doing. When Evans asked Davis if he could arrange one of the trumpeter's originals, Donna Lee, for Thornhill's band, Davis agreed, so long as Evans passed along his take on Robin's Nest. Evans hoped David's boss, Charlie Parker, might ultimately hire him. "Bird never had time to listen to what Gil did," Davis wrote of Parker 40 years later. Because for Bird, Gil only provided him with a convenient place to eat, drink, shit, and be close to 52nd Street. Davis did not make that mistake. He and Evans began hatching plans for a slower and more subtle band, with less attack than Parker's bustling bebop, and an unconventional lineup that borrowed from Thornhill's approach. They began building a Nonet in Evans' basement, foregoing tenor saxophone for alto, baritone, trombone, French horn, tuba, and of course, Davis's patient trumpet. Late in the summer of 1948, the band began the first of two residencies at Manhattan's Royal Roost. Davis convinced the venue to put the name of the arrangers, Evans, Jerry Mulligan, John Lewis, on the marquee, an implicit pronouncement that this wasn't hard-hitting bop. The idea was to sound as full as possible, you know, and still not be too large, Evans said. It could still cover all the harmonic needs that the music could have and the range and tone colors. Capitol Records offered the No-Net a contract, a dozen tunes for 678 RPM singles. Davis and assorted iterations of the No-Net began cutting them in January 1949, finishing more than a year later. The singles didn't really sell. As remarkable as they sounded, the sinking harmonies of Moon Dreams, the rhythmic hide-and-seek of Bundo, the merry wobbly of Boplicity. Here's some of the song Boplicity by Miles Davis. Still, they were the start of Davis becoming synonymous with jazz. It's Godhead. In 1957, Capitol reconsidered those sides and bundled 11 together as Birth of the Cool. Soon after Long Plain Records arrived, just in time to rescue jazz from an incipient case of claustrophobia, as the New York Times put it, then, Birth of the Cool became a bellwether, too, its compact pieces signaling a permanent shift in jazz's dynamic and textural possibilities. Davis had connived his way to New York. His mother, Cleota, had wanted to send him south for school, but the ascendant East St. Louis ace plead his way to Juilliard in Manhattan. In 1944, soon after he graduated high school, he'd seen bebop Pathfinders, Parker, and Dixie Gillespie play. He knew their records, but this was the epiphany, the best night of his life, he later wrote, without sex. Juilliard was only his gateway. I spent my first week in New York and my first month's allowance looking for Charlie Parker, he later told Ralph L. Gleason. I used to follow him around down to 52nd Street, where he used to play. Then he used to get me to play. Davis lasted a year at Juilliard. He wasn't impressed with the white conservative education. He had made his recording debut months earlier anyway, and he was gaining confidence and exposure on Swing Street. Early in 1946, he joined Benny Carter's big band and flew with them to Los Angeles, where he'd play late nights with Parker. Davis had arrived just in time for one of bebop's last great stands. He was about to make the move that would eventually make him a solo star by dropping out of it. In December 1948, only months after those first appearances with the No-Net, Davis finally bailed on Parker. He was a genuine but a con man, Davis reckoned, always filching money for drugs or booze. Davis threatened to kill him over his pay, got half, and quit when the rest never materialized. He had a focus of his own anyway, his No-Net. When Duke Ellington asked Davis to join his band, he demurred. I had to tell him that I couldn't make it because I was finishing up Birth of the Cool, Davis wrote. But the real reason I couldn't go with Duke was because I didn't want to put myself in a musical box. My head was somewhere else. Davis, though, got sidetracked. He had tried cocaine and even heroin on tour, but he'd never fallen for it, suspicious of the myth it might make him play like Parker. But 5 months after leaving Parker's band, he played the Festival of Jazz in Paris. Black men, he noticed, weren't treated as subordinates there. Already a father back home, he began a long love affair with the singer and actress Juliet Greco. When he returned to the U.S., Paris felt like a distant dream. What got me strung out was the depression I felt when I got back to America. That and missing Juliet, he wrote. The only thing I could think about was how I was going to cop me some more heroin. Heroin cost Davis much of the next 4 years. Though he finished the sessions that would become Birth of the Cool in March 1950, he soon went off the rails. Stealing for a fix, pimping for cash, getting arrested for possession. He played live very little, transcribing other people's music to make enough to score and get tossed around by club owners he owed. He landed a deal with the upstart label Prestige, but his playing was uneven at best, unimaginative at worst. The Nonet's breakthrough now seemed far away. He spent some time with his parents in East St. Louis and went to rehab long enough to get cold feet in the waiting room. They had been at each other's throats since I was a little kid, he wrote of his parents. The only thing I ever saw that really connected them up was later when I got my bad heroin habit. After some success in California, he retreated to East St. Louis again, finally convinced heroin had to go. He was, as Ian Carr noted in Miles Davis, the definitive biography, the rare case who broke his habit without professional help. I laid down and stared at the ceiling for 12 days, and I cursed everybody. I didn't like, Davis told Ebony. It was like having a bad case of flu, only worse. Davis slowly rebuilt his reputation, health, and dexterity through 1954 and 1955, launching a dizzying run for Prestige and Blue Note that included several quartet, quintet, and sextets with the likes of Sonny Rollins, Milt Jackson, and Thelonious Monk. In March 1955, Parker, the hero that Davis had chased to New York, died at 34 from the cumulative consequence of his lifestyle. Bird was dead, Davis wrote, and I had to go on with my life. Miles, 1955 to 1960, Blue Horizon, the full flowering of Davis's post-dependency return, accumulating in a mysterious Modal masterpiece. Inspired by the satirical sharpness, physical fitness, and arrogant attitude of his idol, boxer Sugar Ray Robinson, Miles Davis had kicked his heroin habit by 1955 and was playing stronger and sweeter than ever. Although he took part in some heavyweight sessions featuring Sonny Rollins, Horace Silver, and Art Blakey, among others, he was keen to lead his own band. His sporadic appearance on the scene since 1950 meant his reputation was not sufficient to generate enough work for a regular group. Though his potent playing at the Newport Jazz Festival in July 1955, a pickup session featuring Zoot Sims, Jerry Mulligan, and Thelonious Monk, confirmed to the listening jazz world that Miles was back. Both live and on record, his incisive, agitated, boppish lines and the spacious yearning of his ballad playing, whether with his full, expansive open horn or with the punchy, pinched sound of the harmon mute, announced a trumpeter of rare, expressive power. Settled in New York with a raised post-Newport profile, he signed with the influential Shaw Agency and assembled a quintet of extraordinary musical personalities. Saxophonist John Coltrane, the best since Bird in Miles' world, words. Pianist Red Garland, he was hip. Bassist Paul Chambers, a bad motherfucker. And drummer Philly Joe Jones, the fire that made a lot of shit happen. With a repertoire, bebop, and show tunes, along with rhythmic, textual, and structural devices borrowed from the Ahmad Jamal Trio, a wily, deceptively inventive group that Miles had seen many times at the Pershing in Chicago, the quintet's tough, tender debut, the new Miles Davis Quintet, 1956 Prestige, persuaded the mighty Columbia Records to add Davis to their burgeoning roster of jazz stars, including Louis Armstrong, Dave Brubeck, and Duke Ellington. Unconventionally, Davis still owed Prestige 4 albums, so he fulfilled his contract by playing the quintet's fine-horned live set over 2 sessions in May and October 1956, recording 4 exemplary small group albums, Workin', Cookin', Streamin', Relaxin', which Prestige released over the next 5 years. Meanwhile, the quintet gigged consistently, pulling sellout crowds and making their leader proud. "It was so bad," he said in his autobiography, "it used to send chills through me." As a former junkie, he presided over his band of junkies with a certain understanding. "I just tell them if they work for me to regulate their habit," he told Nat Hentoff. "When they're tired of the trouble it takes to support a habit, they'll stop, if they have the strength." Neither Coltrane nor Jones showed any signs of finding that strength. So, weary of his unreliable sidemen, Miles fired them in early 1957. They were temporarily replaced in the quintet by saxophonist Sonny Rollins and drummer Art Taylor, later Jimmy Cobb. But the trumpeter already had his mind elsewhere, taking advantage of Columbia's budget to make a large ensemble recording. Miles rekindled his association with arranger Gil Evans to create Miles Ahead, 1957, Columbia. As the only soloist on the warmer-sounding flugelhorn on Evans' panterly evocative and atmospheric arrangements of Delibres, Alma Jamal, Kurt Weill, and Dave Brubeck material, Davis conveys an almost regal melancholy amid billowing curtains of woodwind, French horns, and tuba, artfully arranged and edited to sound like a continuous piece. It's a veritable jazz concerto and was widely hailed as an orchestra jazz masterpiece. But it wasn't all the plain selling suggested by Miles Ahead cover. At some point between 1955 and 1957, Davis had surgery, perhaps multiple surgeries, to remove benign nodes on his throat. Subsequently, it seems he failed to follow doctor's orders not to talk for 10 days. It said he raised his voice to argue with a promoter, resulting in his voice sounding forever hoarse. The sinister whisper, along with the sharp suits, glamorous girlfriends, fast cars, and man of the moment articles in Time and Life, international magazines, all served Davis's burgeoning mystique as he became the most famous and charismatic jazz musician of the day, and perhaps too successful a black man for some taste. One interpretation of the notorious beating he would take at the hands of the NYPD in August 1959. At the same time, Davis's voice and vision as an artist continued to blossom, evident on a visit to Paris in December 1957 as a guest soloist for Juliet Greco, invited by fan and filmmaker Louis Malle to contribute a soundtrack to his noir thriller, Ascender, Pour, Echafaud, Elevator to the Gallows. Davis recorded moody abstract improvisations with French musicians working from skeletal frameworks. His implicit suggestive approach would produce even richer musical rewards before the decade was out. Here's one song off of that album, Elevator to the Gallows by Miles Davis. Back in New York, Davis had already resumed his quest to expand his sound. Impressed by the musical fire of alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley, he just absorbed everything. He hired him into his quintet in mid-1957 and later did him the honor of a rare sideman appearance on Adderley's Something Else, 1958 Blue Note. But Adderley wasn't the only horn player on Davis's radar. Checking out bop piano legend Theonious Monk at the Five Spot in New York's Bowery, Davis was astonished by a newly clean and invigorated John Coltrane and began fantasizing about a sextet featuring both saxophonists. I felt that Cannonball's blues-rooted alto sax up against Train's more free-form approach would create a new kind of feeling. He remembered in his autobiography, I heard my trumpet voice kind of floating over and cutting through all his mixture. The music would have all the tension up in it. When Monk's five-spot engagement ended, Coltrane was back with Davis, and in April 1958, the sextet recorded Milestones. 1958 Columbia, a muscular, buoyant statement showcasing the group's star saxophonist, straight, no chaser. Le Ansour style abstraction, SIDS ahead, and introducing the leader's growing preoccupation with a Model approach, based on scales rather than chords, the title track. Here's a little bit of the song, SIDS Ahead, by Miles Davis. ¶¶ I think a movement is beginning in jazz, away from the conventional string of chords, Davis said in a 1958 interview. Fewer chords, but infinite possibilities as to what to do with them. A pianist who shared Miles' interest in modal concepts was Bill Evans, a contributor to composer-theorist George Russell's The Jazz Workshop, 1956, Koch. Evans was on hand to replace Red Garland, who had tired of Davis's stylistic pointers and quit, and had an alluring richness to his playing that captivated the trumpeter. Bill had this quiet fire that I loved, Davis said. Crystal notes or sparkling water cascading down from some clear waterfall. A combination of insecurity, exhaustion, and a newly acquired heroin habit meant the sensitive Evans only lasted in the sextet for 7 months, but his playing had impacted upon Davis enough for the trumpeter to base his ideas for his new recording around the pianist's impressionistic approach. In March 1959, 5 months after he had left the band, Evans was back in the studio with Davis, Adderley, Coltrane, Chambers, and Cobb, and new pianist Wynton Kelly, appearing on one track, picking gingerly at Davis's sketches, making musical history in a series of one-take wonders. The result? Kinda Blue. 1959 Columbia was a landmark record that combined the earthrural with the earthy, the cerebral with the sanctified, conjoining modernistic modes with the ancient moan of the blues. Regularly counted among the greatest pieces of music in any genre, Kinda Blue was an instant sensation, bewitching musicians, critics, and record buyers equally. But if it looked like a template for the future of jazz, Davis had no interest in staying in lane. Instead, he would turn back toward Gil Evans, the pair collaborating on the grand orchestral sets Porky and Bess, 1959 Columbia, and Sketches of Spain, 1960 Columbia. The exotic destiny of the latter particularly proved too much for some critics. Mr. Davis, do you feel this new work of yours is jazz? Davis was asked at a 1960 press conference. It's music, and I like it, replied Miles. I'll be playing anything I take a fancy to. This would not be the last time that Miles Davis' musical choices would challenge the critical community, or indeed his established audience. And here's one song off the Sketches of Spain album titled The Pan Piper by Gil Evans and Miles Davis. Miles, 1961 to 1967, Earth, Air, Water, and Fire. After Kinda Blue, Davis found new paths powered by the subtle radicalism of the second great quintet. The January 7, 1960 issue of Jazz's Bible, Downbeat Magazine, carried a banner headlined Miles Davis, The Two Faces of the Enigma. Inside this cover story, drew battle lines. There is no moon for the middle stance, Barbara J. Gardner declared. You choose upsides and you play on your team. What followed was more poemetic than prolific, than profile, depicting the trumpeter as a lightning rod and a knot of contradictions, hard to reconcile and even harder to ignore. This is how Miles Davis entered the 60s. Irrefutable, disreputable, conspicuous, opaque. He seemed to stand in shadow, even with the spotlight fixed on him. For Gardner, a contributing editor at Downbeat, and one of the few black women empowered to cover jazz at the time, his persona presented a conundrum, so flustering that it threatened to undermine his musical achievement. But she hit the mark where it mattered. Davis's ability to pick top musicians as sidemen is unerring. And the influence he wields over their musical expression is almost phenomenal, she wrote, sometimes by subtle suggestion, at times by brutal frankness. Miles whips a musical unit into a cohesive, tight-knit, power-generating single voice. The examples were fresh. Davis had spent the last several years at the helm of a pace-setting band, culminating in the creation of a masterpiece, Kinda Blue. But some challenging transitions were afoot by the end of the 50s, as Bill Evans, John Coltrane, and Cannonball Adderley each departed to pursue their own consequential solo careers. Listen to The Final Tour, the Bootleg Series, Volume 6, which captures a returning Coltrane on one last mission with Davis. Transversing Europe early in 1960, he sounds as if he's already halfway to another nebula. That cohesive, tight-knit bond could only hold for so long. Davis held on for a while longer, making good use of his impeccably suave rhythm section. Pianist Wynton Kelly, bassist Paul Chambers, drummer Jimmy Cobb, and drafting ringers to succeed Coltrane in the tenor saxophone chair. The most enduring was Hank Mobley, who can be heard on both a terrific live date in person at the Black Hawk, San Francisco, and a beloved studio album, Someday My Prince Will Come, with Coltrane making a debonair cameo on the title track. These are chronicle effects, yet Davis later suggested that he'd started to become irked by his own playing during this period. Speaking with the benefit of hindsight in Miles, the autobiography, he rummaged in his wardrobe for a metaphor. Like a favorite pair of shoes that you wear all the time, after a while you've got to change them. Change came in the form of a total overhaul for Davis's quintet. The principal catalyst was drummer Tony Williams, a prodigy only 17 when he came aboard in 1963. With an ultra-crisp technique and the ingenious instinct to articulate pulse in swirling currents, Williams brought a new kind of fluency to the Davis bandstand. He did so in seamless sync with bassist Ron Carter and pianist Herbie Hancock, fellow virtuoso in a rhythm team that would redefine the realm of possibilities for small group jazz. Together with the sure-footed, inconvertly soulful tenor saxophonist George Coleman, they can be heard testing these limits on a series of concert recordings, none more celebrated than Four and More. From early in 1964, consult the opening track on that album, a forward tilt take on So What from Kinda Blue. The cool langour and nonchalance of the album version has been replaced by roaring jet engine combustion. And here's one song from that album, Four and More by Miles Davis, and the title of the song is So What. Davis was in his mid to late 30s at this juncture, hardly an old man, but he carried an acute awareness of cultural relevance and its soft spot, obsolescence. Jazz was opening up to new harmonic and structural freedoms, spearheaded by Ornette Coleman, Cecil Taylor, and others in a critically touted avant-garde. Miles was interested in harnessing those flexibilities without abandoning form entirely, an objective shared by the younger members of the band. And Davis knew it wouldn't take much explicit motivation to get the best out of them. While Miles preferred to talk about music and metaphors and images, after each performance, Tony, Ron, and I would stay up late into the night deconstructing what we played, Hancock recalled in his autobiography, Possibilities. We'd spend hours talking about what had gone down that night and about the what-ifs of what we might play the next night. The spirit of conjectural compulsion eventually produced a riff in the band, with George Coleman driven out of the tenor chair. Davis's first choice to replace him was Wayne Shorter, who'd been turning heads with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Shorter wouldn't abandon that post on principle, so at the urge of Williams, Davis hired Sam Rivers, an intriguing but imperfect fit with his garrulous, woolly style. Check the album Miles in Tokyo and see for yourself. By the fall of 1964, Shorter was available, completing the dream lineup of what we now call Miles' second great quintet, and introducing a level of compositional ambition that put the group in a class by itself. If I was the inspiration and wisdom and the link for this band, Davis mused in his memoir, Tony was the fire, the creative spark. Wayne was the ideal person, the conceptualizer of a whole lot of musical ideas we did. And Ron and Herbie were the anchors. ESP, this band's first studio album, recorded at the top of 1965, announces an intrepid new era. Shorter composed the title track, which opens the album in a propulsive but indeterminate vein, with a harmonic logic seemingly designed to slip through one's fingers. Every member of the group contributed at least one tune on the album, which, unusually for Davis, has no songbook standards. But those tunes, like Stella by Starlight and All of You, stayed in the band's repertoire. They're all over the complete live at the Plugged Nickel 1965, which enjoyed a deluxe reissue this year. Heading into that gig in Chicago, Williams engaged his bandmates in a thought experiment. What if they tried playing anti-music in a way of thwarting their comfort level and restoring risk to the bandstand? They agreed not to cue Davis in. The result? Across more than 7 hours of music is revelatory. You can hear the players straining against their instincts, contesting all presumptions. Hancock often solos with just a scrabbling right hand. Carter bounces on a pedal tone rather than moving through a progression. Williams flagrantly switches up his flow. At times, he almost sounds like he's attacking his ride cymbal with a fencing foil. Here's a little bit of the song All of You by Miles Davis. On several subsequent studio albums, Miles Smiles, Sorcerer, and Nefertiti, released in 1967 and 68, the quintet pushed further into the world of implication that Shorter had introduced, as if opening a portal. By all accounts, he was the only band member whose compositions Davis didn't edit or rearrange. These recordings made a calling card out of oblique ambiguity, sleek complexity, and tensile liberation, belonging to the same cultural movement shaped by the writing of James Baldwin and the films of Stanley Kubrick. Notably, Davis loved the second quintet, even though it frequently pushed him to the teetering edge of his own abilities as a trumpeter and improviser, maybe especially for that reason, a willingness to be challenged by his proteges and the pride he took in that evolution is a core tenet of his artistry. You could reduce everything Miles ever played to an obsession with four elements: deep bass, open space, circular time, and blues falsettos, the critic Greg Tate suggested in 1991, after the trumpeter's passing. In a mystical or metaphorical sense, you could read these constants as earth, air, water, and fire. If Davis spent the 50s carving a path away from bebop orthodoxy, he devoted much of the 60s to defining new modes of modernity. By the end of the decade, as his ear turned toward another zeitgeist, open space and circular time had reconstituted as blistering funk groove, syncopathing the way forward with no less mystery and the same measure of defiance. Miles, 1968 to 1975. Electric Dreams. Davis's most startling and controversial transformation into the dark wizard of interstellar post-jazz, observed by Andrew Mayle. In the afternoon of February the 1st, 1975, at the Festival Hall in Osaka, Japan, a seriously unwell Miles Davis, slowed by the morphine being used to treat a clutch of stomach ulcers and a deteriorated hip, suffered out on stage with a septet that comprised saxophonist Sonny Fortune, bassist Michael Henderson, drummer Al Foster, and electric guitarist Pete Casey and Reggie Lewis. The music these seven men made that day, later immortalized across two double albums entitled Agatha and Pangaea, would prove to be the most divisive of Davis's career. Writing in the New York Times in April of 1976, the critic and musicologist Robert Palmer described Agatha as disjointed, turgid, sloppy, a faltered vision sunk to the level of the shockingly banal. Listening to both albums today, it's thrilling to experience both the power of the music itself and something of the incomprehension that critics, including Palmer, were endeavoring to express. 50 years on from that critical drubbing, Agatha and Pangaea sound like the music of both a misunderstood past and an incomprehensible future. Agatha is a firing stew of bolus space, funk, interspersed with piercing shards of Davis's metallic organ pads and haunted horn wails, while the evening performance, Pangaea, is a sound of artistic exhaustion, gradually transformed into a kind of mournful validation, a beautiful alien spacecraft gradually running out of fuel. That there is fatigue with the artistry makes complete sense, for Davis's Osaka shows were the termini of a creatively exhausting journey that had arguably begun in New York 6 years earlier on February 18, 1969, during a three-hour session at CBS's 30th Street Studios, Studio B. Davis had been experimenting with the new sonorities of electric instruments on 1968's Miles in the Sky and Phils de Kilimanjaro, and thanks to the influence of his new wife, Betty Mabry, later Betty Davis, he had also begun checking out black rock and funk artists, including Jimi Hendrix, Sly Stone, and James Brown, alongside the tape manipulations of Karin's Stockhausen. Yet the music laid down in that February 1969 session had more in common with the spare, enigmatic abstractions of 1967's Miles Smiles, edited by producer T.O. Maceo, to make two sides long suites. It re-represented late 60s jazz in a state of hypnotic ambient abstraction. Davis called it In a Silent Way. That's where I'm going to stop today with the Miles Davis article, but I will continue that next week along with one more article about Miles Davis. And the classic album this week is The Rising by Bruce Springsteen, 2002. A record born of the ashes of the 9/11 attacks? Only an artist of the caliber and with the experience of Bruce Springsteen could pull that off and not create something sappy or trite or vaingloriously vengeful. The Rising is Springsteen's magistral response. He sings forcefully of waking up to an empty sky, of My City of Ruins. Here's some of that song, My City in Ruins, by Bruce Springsteen, off the album The Rising.
Was a blood red circle on the cold dark ground, and the rain is falling down. The church door's thrown open, I can hear the organ song, and the congregation's gone. My city of ruins, my city of ruins. Now the sweet bells of mercy drift through the evening trees, young men on the corner like scattered leaves. The boarded up window, the empty streets, while my brother's down on his knees. My city of ruins, my city of ruins. Come on, rise up. Come on,
the bravery of the rescuers who went into the fire, owns up to thoughts of a little revenge, but knows this too shall pass. I'm gonna pray, gonna find my way through this lonesome day. Assumes the character of a traumatized survivor who feels like he is the nothing man, a ballad that aches and creaks and ultimately may move you to tears. Here's part of that song, Nothing Man, by Bruce Springsteen.
I don't remember how I felt. I never thought I'd live to read about myself in my hometown paper, how my brave young life was forever changed in a mystic light of pink vapor. Darling, give me your kiss. Only understand I am a nothing man.
The Rising is that powerful, that impactful. For the first time since Born in the USA, he is reunited for an entire album with the E Street Band. 18 years on from that huge hit, these long-standing Springsteen compadres, shepherded by Pearl Jam producer Brendan O'Brien, adds a declamatory punch to Lonesome Day in the title track and gives the ballads Nothing Man and You're Missing an eerie, elegiac tone. The album is about anguish, despair, coping, moving on, coming together. It is not about any uprising. This notion of healing is inspirationally encapsulated in Worlds Apart, which deploys the harmonium tabia and vocal styles used in Islamic Sufi music. Here's a little bit of that song, Worlds Apart, by Bruce Springsteen.
bliss and comfort in your heart. Taste the seed upon your lips, lay my tongue upon your scars. When I look into your eyes, yeah, we stand worlds apart. La 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 la.
In Paradise, Springsteen even dares to sing from the perspective of a suicide bomber. Intensely moving stuff. And once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article that I started today about Miles Davis, and then 50 years ago, 1976, 10 key moments in the punk rock history, and a classic album review of Maggot Brain by Funkadelic. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
The plane, the